Hello, this is the Torg Eternity Delphi Council Debriefings, where the storm has a name. We are your hosts, Lehman, Jay, and Mark, and today we will be answering reading and answering a couple of emails, as well as getting into the first cards, cosm cards of the Nile Empire. As a reminder, you can, like these emails, you can write us emails and we will read the emails and we'll answer any questions, etc. And that would be at torgdcd@gmail.com. So let's dig into this first email by Rabbit Ball. Greetings, I have the basis for the spells on the fly mechanism hammered out. All I need now is to test values. The goal is that once this is done, it will form a basis for a full-blown spell design system. The parts I figured out are sketched across various posts on my 500 words blog. While thinking about the ultimate goal, the question of spells with a variable effect came up. By this, I mean spells like Diminish that choose a target to affect, but also choose an attribute. From this, two questions come up. The answers have implications. Number one, when using multi-target on the spell, can you choose the same target to affect, but affect different attributes? Number two, when using multi-target on different targets, do you have to affect the same attribute for each target? These questions explore what counts as targeting. Is the targeting the persons affected clearly are targets, but what about the attributes? If the attribute isn't a target, it shouldn't have to be chosen until the spell is cast, and should be variable for each person affected. If the attribute is a target, it should be possible to cast the spell multi-targeting strength and spirit, for example, or perhaps I'm missing something here. Anyway, any assistance will help. Rabbit Ball. So thank you for the email, and I will, on this one, I will go over what the spell says in kind of detail, and then I will turn it over to Jay and Mark if they have any additional comments or etc. But as always, if anything you hear you think you would work better at your own table, feel free to do so. So the first thing that I wanted to do when I read this is look at the Diminish spell and also think about multi-targeting. And if we look at the Diminish spell, the very first part, it's broken up into three parts. The first one says, Diminish reduces one of the opponent's attributes chosen when the spell is cast and related skills by -2. Separate castings may affect multiple attributes. And it goes on, spellcasters mime an action related to the affected attribute while casting, sneering to reduce spirit, pretending to stumble if reducing dexterity, etc. Reducing strength and spirit does not reduce toughness or shock. So based off of that, for number one, when using multi-target on the spell, can you choose the same target to affect, but affect different attributes? So on this one, it specifically says it reduces one of the opponent's attribute chosen when it's cast. And then as the fluff piece, you are miming an action or doing something that specifies which of the attributes. So it's kind of, if you're working on a sentence, it's going to be the subject of your action. So that is going to be part of the spell casting and the spell. So for that, I would say you cannot choose the same target but affect different attributes using multi-target. So first off, multi-target, you wouldn't use, it would be the actual person, not the attribute. I think that's where you're going there. If you were doing it otherwise, as this target and this target on the same target, that gets really weird and wonky. So then it says, when using multi-target on different targets, do you have to affect the same attribute for each target? I would also say yes on that, because again, when you're casting this spell, part of the casting is miming an action related to the affected attribute. And it kind of would work the same way with various other things, like the Bless ability for the Miracle Bless. It specifically gives examples how, say, an invocation to one deity would say, you know, give me the strength of a lion, and the other one would say something like, give me, you know, the spirit of something else, and or the, you know, the dexterity of a cat, something along those lines. So your casting of it would specify what attribute it was at, and then subsequent castings of it, so your next action would allow you to affect different attributes. As it says with diminished, separate castings may affect multiple attributes. And since you can never cast more than one spell of the same skill in one of your turns, then that would mean that you wouldn't be able to do it in the same turn as either a multi-target or as a multi-action. So that's what I am going with by reading the spell, that you have to choose one of the opponent's attributes, and for that casting, that's what the attributes are that you choose when the spell is cast. And then with it saying separate castings may affect multiple attributes, that's saying that I can't use the same casting of the spell either through multi-targeting the same person, which I still am saying that's not a thing. But if you wish to go that way, I would still say you wouldn't be able to do multi-attributes, because it says you need to do a separate casting to affect other attributes. So, Jay, did you have anything you might want to add to that?
That's pretty much my thoughts on it, too. I guess the bigger meta discussion here is on what counts as a target. And in different games, it's kind of defined in different ways. And I think D&D actually kind of really has the best codified spell template. And it includes a target, which tells you what the target is. So it'll be like one humanoid or one undead or whatever. Mm-hmm. But in this case, in Torg, Eternity, the target's kind of hidden in range. So when you look at a spell or a power, and in range is the distance which it may be projected, measured. Range of touch means the caster must touch, make physical contact with his target for the spell to take effect. You must be able to see your target in order to take effect. So that kind of heavily implies that the subject, the target, is actually the individual. You can't really have a variable of the spell be the target, kind of by definition in this case. That's how I look at it. The target is like an individual, especially also when you look at Diminish specifically, but most of these powers too, the difficulty number is listed as the target's willpower or spirit. So again, saying that the character is the target, it's not a particular ability. That would not be a target, that would just be a variable chosen when casting a spell, much like deciding to spend shock in Isle or any other kind of, like, some spells you can also cast at a higher or lower difficulty, depending on something as well. So there are other things where you can choose, and those don't make it a target of a spell. I suppose if we're going, like, full Isle Spell Lab, you might have some meta spell that affects spells, but that would be outside of this kind of discussion, I think. I agree with Liam.
Okay, and thanks for pointing out both the difficulty being the target's willpower or spirit, as well as how range works. That kind of clarifies or solidifies things a little bit. Mark, thoughts on diminish when other spells, miracles, psionic powers, etc.
Yeah, let me echo y'all's statements on this, and then I agree that as far as the way that diminish is worded in a way that the spells overall are structured, the Storm Knight, the threat, the individual is the target, and the attribute in this case is the modifier or the DN or an attribute of the spell, if you want. So having said that, because that's how it's written, and if you want to go raw, in my opinion that's the way it's going. As a fan of original Torg's gadget schematics, which I absolutely adore, the Spell Lab and Perseverance and the subsystems that drove that, I totally understand when we're looking at this game system and looking at magic, because magic used to be, you know, why does that thing work that way? Well, it's because it's magic, you know, and you want to make magic do a whole bunch of other things. And it's in the modern, and I'm going to say this broadly as a broad paint with a broad brush, gaming generally kind of wants to simplify the system all the way down to where it just goes boom, 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 boom. And there's not as much complexity involved, but then there's this subset of players and game masters that really enjoy the complexity that can be applied or overlaid to certain things. And a lot of the modern role-playing games just don't have that available to them. So if Rabbit Ball, if you're looking to do something where you add that level of complexity because you enjoy the idea that you can take magic and then break it into subsections and manipulate things, and instead of just saying that the target is the person, that now I want to go drill down and say the target is multiple attributes on the person, if you want to write a system that does that, I wholeheartedly encourage you to do that and put it up on Infiniverse Exchange and put it out there for the world to use, because that's something that I think there's a niche out there that really would enjoy. I'm in it. I like that kind of thing. But it has to be the problem that you get, and this is what the modern gamer, I think, if you've ever tried to sit down and figure out old school Spell Lab, you have to spend time working on the Spell Lab and how the Spell Lab worked and how the various components. I mean, you literally had to put time in studying how to cast a spell in the game, like you would if you were a wizard trying to figure out how to build a spell. But for some of us who enjoyed the number crunchings and the buildings and things, we enjoyed that. But when you wrote a new spell, you did all of that, and then you codified it in the layout of what a spell looks like so that it could be quickly done in the game, right? This is not something where, based on the way that this lays out and original Torg did it, that, you know, I'm not going to stop my game for 30 minutes so you can figure out how you're going to cast this spell on the fly. That I'm not doing that. And I'm not encouraging you to create something that lets people do that, because the other four people at the table are now, they've taken their books out, they've got their phone out, their tablets out, they're calling their girlfriend, whatever, and the game has come to a screaming halt while you try to figure out what you're doing with the spell. And that's not the way that the game should be played. But if you wanted to, you know, on the off time, I've created the spell and I want to use it, and you send it to your GM, and your GM looks it over with you, crunches the numbers, says, yeah, you're good, let me see the paragraph that this boils down to, and you've got that, boom, done. That's fantastic. I love that idea. But not a 30-minute halt while one player gets all the focus on them to do their one thing because they think it's cool. I'm not down for that.
I guess before we move to the next email, last thing I'll say is, and if you want something kind of in the middle of just a no or a here's a big, long, complex system to do, I could see adding a perk that says, hey, for these type of things, you can multi... You know, on different targets, you can use different attributes and have it just be a perk if somebody really wants to do that. You know, that guy's spirit and that guy's strength and throw it into a perk or a spell that modifies other spells or something like that.
That almost sounds like that would be a perk that would come off of Magister. Yeah. And there's a term for that in things that are happening that I can't talk about right now that I want to use, and I'm not gonna. And Lehman knows what I'm talking about. I'm like, oh, I want to say a thing.
Okay, moving on. This one's from Daniel. It says, hello, Lehman. First of all, I want to thank you and your fellow hosts for doing the debriefings. So you are most welcome. I lost them out of sight for a while now and just started to hear them as a podcast instead of watching the YouTube videos. So yes, we have this both on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. You just look up Torg Eternity Delphi Council Debriefings, and you can do it in either format. I am a game master of Torg Eternity since 2021, and it was my first try being a GM. I think that's actually pretty cool. To come into the game through Torg Eternity, not through D&D or something else. That's always cool. So fresh and new to the hobby, not fresh as a person. Torg Eternity is my absolute favorite game, and your debriefings help me a lot to GM Torg. So again, this is why I wanted to do the debriefings and why I brought others into the debriefings. So it says, now to my questions. I just heard episode 5, and it is out since over a year now, and you said that there will be a Torg 1.5 in the next crowdfunding. Do you have a schedule when this would be? Because as far as I know, there is no 1.5 Torg so far. So let me just answer this. Yes, Torg 1.5 will be the next crowdfunding. We still have a bit to go, but we are rapidly working on it and getting things playtested and getting things developed. It goes all the way to the top of Ulysses Spiela. Marcus Plaut, the owner CEO of Ulysses Spiela, is working hand in hand with the Torg Eternity team and myself specifically to make sure that what we give out is very good of quality and just makes Torg Eternity even better than the awesomeness that it is now. Also, going forward, both the English version and the German versions will be crowdfunded at the same time. They still have to get out the crowdfunding for Pan Pacifica, so it will be after they do the German version of Pan Pacifica crowdfunding. But it also gives us time to really look deep into the rules and do what we need to do. So sorry I can't give a complete schedule of this date. I would love to be able to have dates, but we're just not at that point yet. But it will be the next crowdfunding, and it will happen. It's not something, if it wasn't going to happen, we wouldn't be having these debriefings, or they wouldn't be on the official Ulysses channel. Marcus is very passionate about Torg Eternity. That's why he bought the IP. I am extremely passionate. We were just talking about all of us authors are very passionate about Torg Eternity. So let's move on to the second question is, because I think he is a really great GM, why is JM no host anymore, and is there a chance that he will be back someday? So I did look it up. It was episode 20, so if you're only on 5, you got about 15 more episodes to go, where I actually was able to tell people what had happened. JM had to go to the hospital for a very bad bacterial infection that was taking him months to recover from. So we just want him to recover as well and as speedily as possible. I'm sure at some point he will reach out to me, or I'll reach out to him, and we will get him involved in Torg Eternity in some form or way, and maybe as a guest host at some point. And then third, Mark a couple of times refer to his game or campaign. Is it possible to see his games on YouTube or as a podcast? Thank you for all your work and effort. Greetings from Germany, Daniel. So, Mark, did you want to talk about that? Your game, your campaigns, YouTube, podcast, etc.
Well, first of all, Daniel, thank you for honoring us with your email and specifically calling out my game. I don't have anything on YouTube where I do that, other than we do Wednesday night stream with Liam, and I don't know where he is on the he's somewhere to my side. I see him down below right there. I'm pointing to him on my screen, but and then a number of others on Roll Hit Die on Twitch, where we get that's where we I guess broadcast right every Wednesday night, and I'm currently running the table through Unhallowed Data, which is the Cyber Papacy mega adventure, but I also showcase the it's probably the redacted storyline that I've been writing that you're referring to, I hope. That storyline I'm publishing on the internet in Infiniverse Exchange, but I run that when we get a break from like a mega adventure or something on the stream. So that's if you find Roll Hit Die on Twitch or wherever, I think he puts it up on, I think it goes up on YouTube.
He does put it on YouTube. It's on YouTube to find it. It's a strange punctuation. Because if you just type in Roll Hit Die as three words, you get all types of D&D stuff and other games. So you have to type in Roll, R-O-L-L, comma, no space, hit, H-I-T, comma, then a space, D-I-E. So it's a real weird way, but if you type in
roll,
that,
hit
die. Yes, so like three words. You roll, you hit, and you die, or something dies. So you can find all of our episodes since we began the Torg Eternity streaming. Man, I want to say that's probably 3 to 4 years ago that we have stuff.
It's been a while.
I started it with Blood on the Blasted Lands, and then other people have been doing it. So we have a lot of Torg Eternity adventures, and he marks all of the he does. It just doesn't say Torg Eternity. It specifically says what book and what act we're doing, so you can look at that. So yeah, you could see my pathetic game mastering as well as Mark's game mastering.
And so, others. I think Mike's. I think we've all run. Mike's run. Rod's run. I don't know. Has Jim run anything?
Yeah, he ran a Revenge of the Caradon.
Oh, did he do Caradon?
Yep. So yeah, we've had, and I know Robert's done it. Maybe when I've not been there, or maybe once when I was there. But I think
Robert's run a couple of those Arorsh. Oh my gosh, those are bad. And we've got. We're finishing off. We're halfway through. Roughly halfway through Unhallowed Data. And then we've got, who's doing Soft Cell?
I'm not sure. I think Rod, maybe.
Yeah, I think it is. I think he's playing it offline so he can run it for everybody. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Wasn't Mike going to run something?
I'm not sure. He was running some of the miniature games that we produced last year.
Yeah, he did the Tribals. He's run a number of the Tribals. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's where you find us right now.
So if you want to watch our Torganized play of various homemade stuff, mega adventures, one-offs, both official and unofficial, there's lots of different things to look at. And again, that's roll, comma, hit, kind of is one word, and then another, or roll, comma, hit, comma,
space.
And then the space, and then die. That's how you...
I don't know why it's like that, but it is.
Yeah. So, thank you both for your emails. And, again, email us at torgdcd@gmail.com, and we will read your emails and answer any questions that you may have. So, now we can move on to the Nile Empire Cosm cards, and we'll see how many we can get through in the time that we have left. So let's go ahead and start with number one, Parting Shot. The opponent may take one immediate action and then escape. All store knights gain two possibilities. The villain may not reappear until the next scene. So, Jay, your thoughts on Parting Shot?
Important word, may. So, if you are facing Pharaoh Mobius in his throne room, you can't just play this and have him piss off and do whatever you were doing scot-free. He doesn't have to go, but you still get your possibilities. Mm-hmm. At least that's my interpretation of this. Because otherwise, this can be a very problematic card as a game master if they play it in the last round. Even if they play it in an earlier round, if it's a reoccurring villain who's popping up like some certain snake named villains.
The one that I always have, the really high voice that imitates an 80s Iron action Cobra. Cartoon.
So if someone plays this on an earlier scene on him, and then now he can't come back when the next scene clearly states he's supposed to. So as a GM, you have to do some juggling. So either reassign that person's role to a different villain, or it might just drastically alter what's going on with the adventure. It depends on how good you are thinking on your feet and modifying things. Especially in the Nile Empire with all the obstacle piling and things can get out of hand and things can drastically change from what they were a moment ago. So it is entirely possible that this can almost make the players like instantly win an encounter, only to later find that it wasn't quite the win they thought. It's flavorful. You just gotta be kind of careful how it gets used and make sure be careful not to mess yourself up too bad with it.
Mark, your thoughts on Parting Shot?
I'm not a real big fan of Parting Shot. It you're making the bad guy go away, which I get. You know, if you're getting your butt kicked and you need him to leave, boom, okay, he gets to do one thing and then he's gone. But you get two possibilities for driving. I mean, it's essentially an I win this encounter card, and you get two possibilities for that. And that just seems wrong to me. As Jay pointed out, if you're going to have to take some dramatic license with this, I read the may not line a little different than he does, in that it's the villain may not reappear until, as in he can't reappear next scene, is how I read that. But as he pointed out, if you're running a published adventure and the next scene has that villain showing up again and the plot hinges on that villain showing up again, you may have to, as Jay said, get creative. You know, if you're in the middle of Liamon's hated chase, and you play this and he buggers off, he doesn't.
Thank you, players.
He doesn't leave the MacGuffin they were chasing behind. Okay, he's leaving and he's taking all his toys with him. So you know they're getting their reward of two possibilities. Don't give them the MacGuffin that they wanted also. And how does that happen? Well, it's the Nile Empire, and so he has a nifty gadget that helps him do it. He's teleporting out. He's got a rocket car that has an escape capsule built into it, or a giant robot comes and defends, you know, intercedes, and he escapes because he feels like he's overwhelmed. Whatever. It doesn't matter. Make something up. It's dramatic. Be over the top because it's the Nile Empire, and that's how things go, right? So, but I don't like it just because it's a – you know, you've set up this is the thing that GMs hate. I put a lot of work into setting up this fight and this series of events that's a lot of fun and it's dramatic and it's over the top, and two rounds into it I flip my second card, somebody drops this on the table because they don't like the way it's going, and now all that work that you put into it, you got to wad it up, throw it in the can, and come up with something else. okay, find a way to save the work that you put into it. Insert another scene that's something else. Call that the end of a scene. Make up another scene that's something else, and then bring that thing back and do it again. I don't know. I don't like it.
I'll say, I think my players just always misread this or misunderstood it. They always played it when they've taken out everything and then they wanted the bad guy to come back and they didn't want to just kill him. So they would play it so that he would get one last shot in and then be able to escape, or maybe that's just what they thought would be fun. As Jay said, it does say the opponent may take one immediate action and then escape. And the punctuation does not help. So taking the may as a, maybe they don't take immediate action, or maybe they don't run away, maybe they just take the immediate action and stay. There's a lot of wiggle room. So this is one that I will say, Game Masters, you might want to determine the first part of this card to figure out how it's going to work at your table. I might
do that when they play it and say, hey, you know, if you play that, this is what's going to happen. You sure you want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And then let them, after you tell them this is how I'm going to interpret it at this time, then let them decide if they really want to lay it down or not.
Still two possibilities.
Yeah, it is two possibilities.
So. It is still two possibilities. And they should have to pay for those.
So, I think it's flavorful. It is a way... like I said, my players usually did it when they were about to win. They didn't do it as let's just get rid of the big bad at the beginning. So maybe I just have considerate players, but I think they probably just read it wrong. And if they watch this, they'll be like, next time we'll be able to, they always played it similar. And I've even had them play this and Inevitable Return, like as they were killing a person to bring him back, have him shoot once and then run away, you know, things like that. So, card stacking, which can be fun. So let's move on to number two, In the Crossfire. Play during any battle to add 1 BD, which is a bonus die, of innocent bystanders to the area. These individuals need saving more than most other civilians. A character gains 1 possibility for each innocent he rescued. So, Jay, what are your thoughts on In the Crossfire?
I love this card. It really gets that Nile action going. I did have it get played in a Nile Aurorish mixed zone, which caused some issues. but it's good. It could give a lot of possibilities in total, but generally it's only the character doing the saving of each person that gets it. So it could be one person, if they save everybody, gets a ton, or it could be everyone kind of pieces it out amongst themselves. So that's good. It's kind of up to the players to an extent too. It's like, hey, if you want the possibility, you go and pull this kid out of the burning building. Otherwise, you're not getting it. Really like this one.
Mark, your thoughts on In the Crossfire.
Yeah, I love this card. This card is very Nile Empire. The caution I would have for this card is don't set up your innocence in such a way that one person can do something and say, oh, well, I saved all 10 of them by my actions. This is more of a, as Jay was pointing out, this is more of a, there's a burning building, there's a bunch of people in the burning building. You can go in and get 1 or 2 of them and pull them out, but you didn't get all the other 8 that are in rooms on other floors and everything, versus a bus full of 6 people or 5 people or whatever. And so instead of, you know, you drove off the guy that was riddling the bus with machine gun fire, and because you drove the guy off, now you saved all 5. So, I mean, hey, if you want to run it that way, that's fine. But it's, in my opinion, this is more because it can be, like Jay said, or I'm not paying attention. I'm sorry. I'm very tired. I don't know who said it, but one of you guys said that it's potential to have a lot of possibilities unbalancing for one person or another. In my opinion, it's designed for everybody to go in and get 1 or 2 innocents and take them out, and so everybody gets. But I mean, ultimately, the table just had however many possibilities you dropped, bumped the whole party. So, yeah, like it. This is a good card.
So yeah, I like it. I think it's very flavorful. I would also try, if possible, I would try to make it so that the individuals are scattered and not in a big group, so they couldn't just all be saved at once. And I would put them in the crossfire, make sure that they are in peril, so the group wouldn't necessarily say, Joe's low on possibilities, so he can save one every round while the rest of us are doing this other things. I would be having some either the burning building is burning the innocents, or they're getting actual caught in the crossfire. I would make it so that they know these innocents will perish if they don't get rescued. Not just we're just not going to rescue them, but we're going to try to beat the threats first, and then that'll take away all the danger. So I would have the danger be something that just couldn't be removed that way. But otherwise, yeah, I really like the card. Very flavorful. When it comes up in the middle of a fight, it's always fun to see who spends the time to rescue and who keeps fighting. You kind of see how the players are, so that's fun. So moving on to number 3, Captured. Play when any Storm Knight is slain. He is instead KO'd, captured, and immediately taken from the area by his foes. Any allies who perish in this scene share a similar fate. So, Jay, your thoughts on Captured?
This is a card that sounds good at first, but the more you think about it, the more problematic it becomes. Like, the first thing is, like, how many times... We've talked about it before. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to fail horribly and be defeated for this card to even be useful at all. If you don't get slain, it's nothing, right? So first you have to get slain, which happens so rarely because there's so many ways for Storm Knights to get out of that. But then it gets to the part where, okay, you're still KO'd, captured, and taken away. And how does this happen immediately? As the GM, you're just like, how? Like, is a blimp from above just suddenly shooting a grappling hook and off they go, or what? Like, it's got to be something incredibly ridiculous like that, because so many times you're going to be somewhere where it just doesn't really make too much sense. And then it's got this provision where any allies that perish for the remainder of the scene have the same thing happen. And scenes aren't necessarily just always located in one spot. Like, some scenes can take place over, like, days or just, like, multiple areas. So maybe you guys were at a gin joint that got raided by the cops and then you were going to get shot, but instead you got arrested. But now the fight broke out and it spilled out into the alley and turned into a chase. And now you're out in the desert. Like, how does this happen? So I don't like this card. It asks too many questions for its worth, in my opinion.
Mark, your thoughts on Captured?
I don't like this card purely because it's so rarely used. It's a very niche card. I think it's a fantastic card if it comes up. As Jay pointed out, you don't have a slain Storm Knight very often. But if you had, say, you're facing a TPK and somebody's holding on to this card, this is insurance against everybody getting wiped out. Now, are you going to wake up in the Omegatron with Mobius standing there watching, I've just sucked one life, 1 year of your life. How do you feel? Is that a fate worse than death? Well, you're not dead. I mean, but if they get just one of you, now you've kind of sidetracked your entire whatever you had planned. So maybe you need to have a death trap in your back pocket just in case somebody gets picked up, because it's the Nile Empire, right? And they're not going to whack the guy. They absolutely are going to put him in a death trap because they want to lure the rest of his compatriots, and he's bait now. And so that's why they kept him alive, etc. I don't see a problem with the how, as Jay does. I mean, yeah, does a blimp drop a grappling hook and grab him? Absolutely. It's the Nile Empire. When you go from the Jinjoid to the desert, the stealth blimp has been following you the whole time. It still drops the grappling hook for the other guy, sure. Or you've got the shadowy figures running around in a indescript news van that pulls up and the side doors pop open and the ninjas run out, grab you and put you back in the van. The van keeps following you around. You know, Bedouins on horseback pull up out of nowhere. They were a mirage before, and now they solidify into horsemen who pick you all up and take you out of the desert. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can get around that. Is it, do you have to be creative and think on your feet? Yes, you absolutely do. Could that be a problem? Yeah, it absolutely could. Is it going to come up very often? No. And that's why I don't like it, because it doesn't come up very often. Yeah, you don't get anything for it other than you're saved.
It can't be inevitably returned.
Right. This is one that I will liken to other ones that we might have talked about as the Savior Bacon, and that's about it. Where if it's a way to keep somebody from dying, that's great. Otherwise, you're not going to use it. So it's... And we pointed this out on the stream yesterday, Mark. We had a character that actually had to make a defeat test. And I think it was the first one for the entire stream. So as I said before, that's been going on 3 or 4 years.
I nearly killed Electo.
How often this card would be used, I say, would be minimal. But it is useful for that one small time when you need it and you happen to be in the Nile Empire, because we weren't, so this card wasn't even an option.
Not an option.
Let's move on to number 4, round 2. Play during encounter. Heroes recover all shock, but a new twist is added for the rest of the encounter. A storm, a fire, etc. When any dilemma appears on the drama card, all characters, including villains, must make an appropriate roll. Dodge of falling rocks, strength of resisting smoke, etc., or suffer a wound. So what are your thoughts about round 2, Jay?
Yeah, this one's pretty good. I feel that it's a bit limited in that it only procs off of dilemma appearing on the drama card, which doesn't happen that often. And if you have any characters that can manipulate the drama deck, it will not happen. So it's kind of just, at that point, it's kind of just like heal your shock, which is okay. I like to have whatever the twist is be more than just this, though. Like, if it is a fire, then it sort of adds a clock to the encounter as well. So I like it to act a little bit, have a little bit more going on. The question is, if you're a player, is when do you play this, right? Because it's kind of making things more difficult for you as well. So the only time I can really see this coming up a lot is if multiple characters are low on shock. Because playing it, even just if one person is close to being shocked out, it does suddenly make life much harder for everybody. So, I mean, it's okay, but it's questionable how much it gets used.
Your thoughts on round 2, Mark?
Yeah, this is another one that's got limited niche use, but if you've got a shock monkey in the group that activates a bunch of their abilities by taking shock, and they do it regularly to, you know, affect the card, take things off the card so it doesn't affect the heroes, switch lines, get bonus dice, or kick off, you know, abilities on their path for Pan's Pacific or whatever that take a lot of shock, this is a savior card for those characters. Jay's correct in that the longer the fight goes on, the less useful this becomes, because you're getting near the end anyway, and it's not going to matter necessarily if you got one wound left on the bad guy and all of your, you know, you're almost shocked out, but you're not the big, the big hitter in the group. So, you know, is it good? Yeah, you get all your shock back. Is it good for everybody? Probably not.
Yeah, I agree. I think this probably would have been better if it was play and everybody would recover a wound. Because at the end, you have the chance of there being multiple wounds. So you could have gained a wound, and then based off of how many dilemmas or whatever pop up, you could suffer multiple wounds or spend a lot of resources avoiding those wounds. Mm-hmm. I think that would probably be more exciting and more balanced than just recovering shock. But it's still,
or give everybody a possibility or two, because then it would get played. If I'm like, everybody gets a possibility out of this card, but you could suffer wounds if you fail rolls, and I've got one possibility, and we're going into a dramatic scene against the big bad, chances are good I'm going to play that at some point, because I'm going to need to soak something. Mm-hmm. Right, and I'm like, sorry guys, I got to put this down.
Or you could use it and give some narrative control to the players and say, okay, what's the dilemma? And they can mm-hmm. tailor it to be something that they're good at. But that also might get old after like the second or third time this card gets played.
So yeah, I would, as game masters, I would look at this, and if you see this not being used often in your game, you might take a few of our suggestions, possibly tweak it, or just remove it, because as we mentioned before, there's nothing stating that you have to use every single card in every single session. So let's move on to 5. Suddenly random violence erupts as a crew of villainous henchmen rampage through the area. The attack may be related to a larger plot or complete coincidence. All players gain 1 to 3 possibilities once the villains are stopped, depending on the strength of the foes. So, Jay, your thoughts on suddenly
Dino Attack? All right, we've talked about all these, but this does have a couple of key differences. One is that it's henchmen. Mm-hmm. So unlike, say, the Core Earth one, where it's a, you know, reality-rated person, this is a bunch of chumps. So probably mob goons or something like that. I wouldn't even really do a masked villain either, just their goons. And secondly, it doesn't actually say anything about them attacking the player characters.
Mm-hmm.
They're just causing chaos. So I have had players play this card purely to cause distractions. And have nothing to do with fighting them. I don't give them possibilities if that's what they're doing with it, but I think aside from Dino Attack, just from sheer quantity of it being drawn, this is probably the most played of those monster cards mm-hmm. that I've in my campaign. Like, it has more utility than a lot of the others.
So your thoughts on suddenly, Mark?
Yeah, we've covered these before. This is a 1 to 3 card that, you know, based on, and I think it's Liaman's approach that it's you award, or maybe it's Jay's, you award possibilities based on how easy or hard they deal mm-hmm. with whatever you throw at them, not based on what you throw at them, which I think is a fantastic approach on this card. But I will diverge from Jay on the thing that says, you know, henchman. Okay, well, a masked villain who is the lieutenant of the boss could be considered a henchman, so I could consider that to be thrown in there. I would take liberties with the threat that's thrown at them. For, you know, if they're going to get 1 to 3 possibilities, I'm not going to give them 3 possibilities for mooks that come in and they just go and smash them and then walk on, right? But if you give them, you know, the Iron Cobra, who is Mobius's henchman in this particular whatever example, and he shows up with a bunch of shock troopers and hilarity ensues. Okay, whatever. But it's the same card. It just, and it gets played, as Jay said, it gets played frequently. So if you're running Nile Empire, you absolutely need to be prepared for this one, because it's going to get tossed in there. And you're going to be doing something like an investigative thing in the bazaar where they got to figure out where the breadcrumb trail is that leads them to the death trap you've laid for them, and they're going to play this. And you're like, all I had was investigations and some, you know, find rolls and stuff like that. Now what are we going to do? Okay, well, they roll up and then you can go back to that after. So definitely prepare for this one.
So yeah, I'll just say, look at any of our other probably part ones for ones with similar language.
Living Land's a good one for that.
Yeah. So let's move on to 6, dramatic reveal. A villain reveals some dramatic secret or advantage over your hero, such as a captured loved one, that he's a blood relative, or some other sinister secret. Your hero suffers a -4 penalty to all tests when acting directly against this villain for the rest of the scene. Gain 2 possibilities. So, Jay, what are your thoughts on dramatic reveal?
I really like this card. It lets the player, you know, add some personal element to an encounter. And actually, this is kind of... I remember reading about Torg way back when, maybe in a White Wolf magazine or something, before I'd ever picked it up, and it was talking about the cards, you know, because it was... back then it was one deck of cards, and how the people were playing it, and then suddenly a subplot came up and the villain was like, we meet again, and the player's like, what do you mean, we've never met? It's like, no, we did, how did we meet? And then the was like, I've never thought about doing it like this. And nowadays, like, narrative games are like all the rage, it's what everyone does. But so this card reminds me of that article and about how Torg was so different when it first came out. And it lets the player add something to the encounter within reason, or the GM can do it, I suppose. But -4 penalty is a little bit rough, but that's tests affecting them. I, you know, wouldn't count for like soaking and stuff like that, in my opinion. And they can go deal with the, you know, the other things they need dealing with. It's just affecting the actual main villain that gets the -4. So it might not be a huge deal depending on who has this card. But if it's on your main, like, katana-wielding electric samurai, then it might be a problem. Either way, 2 possibilities is nice. And personally, I would trade in a cool backstory for a -4 any day. But I guess your mileage may vary in your group.
So, Mark, what are your thoughts on dramatic reveal?
I like this card a lot. Especially, mostly for home game, because it doesn't really work well... as well in Torganized play. You get the minus, you throw in some element, you get the -4, and it's a mechanical thing, boom, off you go. But in a home game, this rewards players that know what their backstory is. And when your player plays this, unless you've got something that you've already baked in that's going to be a real fun hook, ask your player, okay, so what dirt does so-and-so, what dirt does the Iron Cobra have on the Masked Avenger? And then just stop talking and let your player explain to you what dirt your hero or your villain has on him or her. And take notes. If you're not taking notes on contacts and nemesis and romance and stuff like this when you're running a home game, you really are missing out on enormous amount of material to deepen and enrich the story, the backstory that goes all through the cosmos on all your Storm Knights, because this is an opportunity for you to let the players pay off that backstory that they've been, even if they don't have it written down, that everybody thinks about. I think everybody thinks about, well, who is my Storm Knight? Who is my hero? Why is my adventurer, you know, a barbarian that doesn't like armor? Or why is my hero, you know, a Nile Empire hero? Why did he put on the mask? Or why did she take up the mask? You know, those kinds of things. And this right here, like, okay, well, you know what? You've got a -4 against this villain. By the time the combat ends, you need to tell me what this villain has on you, because it might be important, okay? And now it's important whether or not the villain gets away. Could be. Anyway, I love this card. This is a great card.
So I like it also to back up Jay, the subplots and stuff like that from Classic Tor were just wonderful. And one of the things that any game master, any table could do, but it was specifically baked into the original card deck, was the campaign subplot. So I actually have a house rule that if somebody plays the same subplot twice, it becomes campaigned. So what happened in Classic Torg is you could play that romance, and it would last the... I can't remember if it was the scene or the act. I think it was an act, but like the general thing normally would last an act. And then if you had a campaign card, you could play it on that subplot while that subplot was active, and then it would make mm-hmm. it a permanent part of the game. And that was something that I really enjoyed, and I had all the subplots for every character listed. And when Torg Eternity didn't have it, one of my first house rules was that if, say, you did a romance on somebody, and then you or somebody played a romance and got that relationship established, then they played another romance, then I used that as the campaign card to make it last. Now, you could do it where you could have the normal romance be that thing, but this dramatic reveal, adding another way to do that is always fun, because then it can interact with other subplots or be something completely separate, a new level, a new layer. So any and all of that stuff, I always love backstory that gets added during gameplay. I know a lot of people love making the long, complicated backstories before the game, but in my personal preference is having that happen during the game, and all of the stuff in Torg Eternity that allows for it, I think, is pretty cool.
It writes the story and helps you expand it in ways that mirror life, because you don't always expect what's going to happen. Mm-hmm.
So let's go ahead, and we're going to do one last one today. Card number 7, Temporary Reprieve. Play at any time to avert a catastrophe, including failing a dramatic skill resolution. Any combat ends, and the villains withdraw, allowing the heroes time to recover shock before the situation resumes or an alternate problem arises. So, Jay, your thoughts on Temporary Reprieve?
I don't think I've ever had this card played. So, I don't know. It seems pretty niche, to be honest. But it does fit. Like, I could think of, like, Indiana Jones or something where there'd be, like, an action sequence and then, like, a block falls between two groups and everything gets paused. And then,
or even like
immediately resumes
a Phantom Menace,
Star Wars,
that
Darth
kind of
Maul
stuff,
fight.
Right? Exactly, yeah. So I like it in theory, but as we have discussed previously, how often do DSRs fail, right? But it is any catastrophe, so it's not just limited to DSRs. And players have a way of creating their own catastrophes, so this could be an insurance card. Yeah, it seems okay, but like I said, I don't think I've ever seen it actually used, so I don't know if the players have just never drawn it or it's never actually just come up.
So, Mark, your thoughts on Temporary Reprieve?
Very Nile Empire. I've seen it played. I think I don't know if I've played it or if I was in the group that played it, but as Rod likes to do, he likes to have combats with DSRs, and in the Nile Empire, combats with death traps, because death traps are a DSR, just gets even worse, right? And so you drop this on that, and you know, the Star Wars, the blast doors close and separate Vader from Luke as they're trying to get off the Death Star. Or the Phantom Menace, which shuts down the whole fight because that the timer went off and everything stopped and Qui-Gon Jinn kind of just wait and then they start up again. Yeah, so it doesn't happen very often. It is a niche, but it's kind of a get out of jail free card if you know things are dice are rolling poorly for you and everything's gone south and you got beat up real bad and you still have to make a bunch of really good rolls.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. It's very flavorful. It fits the Nile. use may or may not depend on if your characters or your players get this card and if they have a situation where it's useful. I believe when I was taking my group through Fires of Ra, there is a DSR that's happening. And then it is both the players and the villains trying to get out of something at the same time. So they were fighting each other, and then this thing happens, and then they're fighting and trying to escape. And I want to say the player played this to give time for the heroes and the villains to look at each other, say, hey, let's help each other out of this death trap. And then we can resume the hostilities afterwards. But there were other scenes where I think this also might have helped. They just didn't have the card. So I think that's the one time I've seen it. So that is our episode for today. Thank you very much for either watching and or listening. Check us out next time when we move through more of these, starting at card number 8. Please do email us with any of your comments or questions at torgdcd@gmail.com. And until next time, we hope you have fun in your own Cosmverse. Bye.